This is SMQB's lucky number 13. That's right, episode 13. And it is a fun one. We have a Masters recap that we're going to talk about. And then more or less the rest of the show is dedicated to beating up on Major League Baseball for one of a host of reasons that are pretty easy. So check it out. And listen, hey, if you guys enjoy the podcast, do us a favor, leave a review. Give us some stars. Everybody likes five stars. So do us that or tell your friends to listen and have fun with the show. You think it's a good one.
Tired of the same old sports analysis? Then you need the SMQBs podcast. They're five attorneys. They're sports fanatics, and they're ready to make their case. Welcome to Sports Talk with an Edge. From Dallas, Texas, Ryan Pope. Michael Rooster Phelan from Richmond, Virginia. Patrick Milk Michler from Tampa. Toby House Milrod from Philadelphia. Chris Bison Nace from DC.
Episode 13, lucky number 13 for the SMQBs. And it is a week of drama on the green and for those in the green. House, what quarterback for the Eagles took the last offensive snap last year?
That's a great question. But it was not Jalen Hurts.
It was not
Carson Wentz.
I believe
I think it was Sudfeld or whatever his face was.
Nate Sudfeld has signed with San Fran. The Eagles are without another quarterback. It's just every week there's an Eagles quarterback story.
Is there no number two?
Who knows? Who knows at this point?
Wow. All right.
Did you hear the Pats cut Edelman just now?
Yeah. Breaking news.
His physical.
Yeah.
Is he already on the Bucks?
He's retiring, right?
He's retiring.
He's just going to retire his knee. He didn't pass the physical because of his knee.
The Eagles just traded a first-round pick to pick up Edelman to play quarterback.
Yeah, he played quarterback in high school.
That's right.
Yeah, the same way Gronk retired. He'll be on the Bucks by tomorrow morning.
Yeah, his knee will be fine.
Let's talk together
for Mr. Brady.
Wow.
The master plan.
Oh, speaking of master plan, let's talk nice about segue. The real green that mattered. Nice segue, Milk. Take us away on the Masters Tour.
Well, I'd love to, but I think the first thing I'm going to do is start off with an apology to our listeners, because if you tuned in last week and were smart enough, stupid enough, I don't know, to take our picks and then take your hard-earned money and gamble according to those picks, then you most likely lost every penny that you had. I'm going to throw out some names here. These were our predictions for the Masters champion. Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas, DeChambeau, who I believe the quote from Pope was something along the lines of he was going to tame the fairways. Or
bring the course to its knees.
Bring the course to its knees.
Pretty sure okay. I said he could.
Correct.
Oh, here we go.
Lee Westwood was thrown out there. Brooks Koepka. That was another one.
Oof.
And Morikawa, although there is a dispute on whether it was Matsuyama.
I said Matsuyama.
Correct. I don't think so.
No, you know, we really need our post-production team to work on the audio clarity.
You don't get the Japanese name field on that. Sorry.
Guys, I think it's time we face the music. We got crushed there. I don't even think any of those guys, none of them were relevant.
I picked Spieth.
Spieth,
okay. You're right. You did.
We got one out of 10.
You had him as your pick and your dark horse, which maybe that gave him extra oomph.
And then I did just what Patrick's accused me of doing during March Madness. I turned around and picked somebody else for my pool.
Right.
But you won your pool.
I did the same thing. But we're going to let that pass. Anyways, listeners, don't give up on us because we are going to make you some money before the end of the year. I don't know how.
Here's an inside tip to the listeners on that score. The more confident that Pope and House sound, the less likely they are to be correct. So we're already in the opposite direction.
Oh, so we're already forgetting Oral Roberts.
Who's that? What are we talking about?
Milk, did you like the Masters?
I think, by the way, a special apology to Nace's cousin if he's listening. And I think his house is getting foreclosed on next week.
He may not be listening anymore. He used to listen.
He can't afford the Wi-Fi connection any longer.
Yeah.
But look, congratulations in order for Hideki. Really, he's kind of like the best golfer, I think, that everyone kind of doesn't really know about, or he's not on anyone's radar, but he's actually really solid. I mean, I think he was as high as he was number two in the world at one point. And I remember when he won the Memorial in 2014, and he was supposed to be this next big thing. And I think he won a few more tournaments and kind of fell off, but I'm not shocked that he won a major. I feel like that was going to happen in his career, but everyone's kind of, I guess shocked because he sort of fell off and he's not really well known. He's not one of these big names like DJ and these Brooks and all that. But can I just say, as a guy who appreciates the pressures of golf, what it must be like to have literally an entire country rooting for you,
right,
to win a major. Like, this guy went in with a 54 hole lead, and he is the only player relevant in Japan. Like, there's no one else. We're kind of spoiled as Americans because there's a ton of great American golfers. We're usually winning a major at least 3 out of 4 every year. This guy is the only player in Japan that's relevant on the PGA Tour. And to go into that Sunday, and the wheels could have fallen off. I mean, number one, he started off in trouble. There was a couple times throughout the round that, you felt like it could go the way of Xander, and we'll get into that in a second. But he played well enough to win. He didn't shoot a great round, 73, but it was good enough. And to do that with the weight and the pressure of an entire country rooting for you, I don't know. I just thought it was pretty awesome. And that's a lot. I mean, winning the Masters is hard enough. Doing that and winning it for your country, who is all rooting and tuning in, just seems even more challenging. So good for him.
Do you guys remember when Ichiro first came into Major League Baseball and the amount of press coverage he would get from the Japanese press? And he was like, one of nine people on the team. This guy's out there playing solo for the country. I mean, amazing pressure, I'm sure.
Yu Darvish had the same phenomenon when he came to the Rangers. I mean, the media was just all over him.
That was one of the more interesting observations they said yesterday, that the Masters, the media is not allowed inside the ropes. And it's an interesting thought that if the Japanese press were allowed inside the ropes for the 4 days of that tournament, whether the pressure would have gotten to Hideki, because that would have been a massive, like you guys said, with Darvish and Ichiro, the massive number of media, he actually had the benefit of being able to block that out inside the ropes and not have to put up with any of that media circus.
And how cool was it that Schauffele spoke Japanese and was able to talk to him during the Saturday and Sunday rounds? I mean, he's a class act. I have to give him that. Schauffele is a class act.
It's really good for the game of golf when these countries break through. But particularly, I mean, it's been very clear in golf for the last several years that, the Asian continent, their interest in golf and, just they're crazy, crazy about it. And there have been a lot of, they discussed on the broadcast, there was Shingo Katayama and it was Seo Aoki, and even going back to Tommy Nakajima and all these guys, but no one had ever broken through. And so for that country, for Hideki to break through, I mean, he's a forever hero, forever.
The funniest about Nakajima was he was on the broadcast. He was the voice of the Tokyo sportscast, and they kept playing him whenever that, he either hit a really good shot, or the worst was when he hit over the green into 15. And I think, House, you texted, can you say Vandevall in Japanese?
Well, but that, I mean, yeah, look, it, Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
No, it's, you know, I like to have my virtual background, which kind of represents my thoughts on a pod. And for our listeners, maybe you can see on our Facebook page, but I've got more the caddy for Hideki bowing as he is taking the flag away. The amount of cultural respect that that they have for the game, that the Japanese people have, you know, they've been talking about, is Hideki going to be either A, the bearer of the Olympic torch as they're going to light the cauldron in Tokyo, or is he going to be carrying the flag for the Japanese contingent as they come out into the opening ceremony? So hard for us to understand the impact that this has. And, you know, Tiger and Jack both tweeted, and I retweeted for the SMQBs last night, great quotes where they were honoring, he was both honoring Hideki and talking about the great impact it would have on the game of golf worldwide by having Japan have a green jacket. So, you know, hats off, bow, curtsy, whatever, to Hideki and his crew.
So, you know, it's funny. So I was thinking a lot about this because there's always a lot of hyperbole in sports, and in watching all the discussion about what it means for Japan and for a culture and all this stuff, I sort of stopped for a second and started thinking, like, is this just media hyperbole at this point? And I was trying to think, like, it's the Masters. That's, I get it. But I really started thinking, like, why does this mean so much for a country? I mean, what does it mean? Why do you get there? And I guess I got back to the point where sports, even for a bunch of guys like us who are past our prime, dare I say, and
speak for yourself.
More towards middle age than not, but
even pop, you know,
sports are still for kids, right? And even for adults who watch it, it's a kid's fantasy land, and that's why we get so enthralled by it, I think. And I think when you talk about what this must mean for a country, I kind of have been focusing on what it means for the kids who are picking up golf clubs today, or who will start to play the game because their families had them up at what, 2 a.m. to start watching the round yesterday. And I think that's the story, at least to me. That's why it's not hyperbole to talk in the context of how much it means for a country, is that there will be a generation of kids who will grow up with an interest in the game of golf because they will remember being shaken out of bed in the wee hours of the morning to go and watch the final round. And I think that's kind of one of those common denominators for all people across the world, right? The interest and the really what's almost living vicariously through that athlete who's out there and doing something great, and why you root for him so much. So, you know, I don't want to say I was skeptical of the importance of the story, but I actually tried to think about it as opposed to just going with the moment. I'm even more swayed as to what a big story it is.
Let's not forget that Japan swept the Masters. The women's yep. Masters was won by a Japanese golfer.
Well, and Hideki said he was inspired by that teenager who won the National Augusta Amateur for women the weekend before. I think she was 17 years old.
Here's the really cool thing about the Masters for that entire country. Sometimes I think we forget, you know, of course, the other three majors in golf, they rotate, you know, so PGA is always somewhere different. The Open in Britain is on a rotation, and the U.S. Open. Masters is the Masters, always in Augusta. And so every single year when you see these holes, if you turn on the television in Japan, you get to relive the glory of the same hole. You know, you get to relive the shot of where he made birdie, where he did go into the creek, and where they got nervous. So I remember, and that's what's so cool about the Masters. Same course, same azaleas, same raised creek, same bridge, and they get to relive that glory of the same course every single year.
Yeah, it's an awesome experience. You guys, you've been there, right, House?
Yeah, I was there in this Spieth meltdown to Danny Willett.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's tough to stomach.
Well, so speaking of meltdowns.
I was there in 09.
Yeah. Let's talk about meltdowns, because this.
Angel Cabrera won in 09.
That's right.
Sorry, Mel. Sorry, Mel.
So I was kind of texting everyone. Y'all remember yesterday that I thought the Masters was going the way of very boring.
Told you.
And then we get to the 15th hole. Hideki in the water. Xander's in the sand. He gets out. He birdied, right? And then
close to eagle.
Yeah, he was so close.
Hideki, that's 1 inch for our listeners.
Yeah, let the record reflect that Brian Pope was holding his fingers about an inch apart.
Hideki bogeys, right? So what did it get to at that point? Two?
Two. It was 12. Yeah. Hideki was 12 and Shoffley was 10 going into the tee.
And then we go 16. To 16 and tough moment for Xander. Wow.
And you know what the thing is? If you'd been watching throughout the day, 16 was an unbelievably gettable par three that day. There were a lot of guys. There were guys that were scaring that hole from a hole in one, like one after another. It was a totally gettable, forget about par. It was a gettable birdie hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, he just choked. I mean, literally. It was tough to see.
I mean, it was hard. You know, Dottie Pepper said a wall of wind hit it, but Shoffley admitted that they misplayed the wind. He said he hit the right club as far as what he wanted to do. He just misplayed the wind. But you can't do that. You got to make sure you get the ball up on the spine, like Brandel Chamblee said. You get it up there and let it roll down. Got to hit a 7 instead of an 8. Hideki hit a 7 and he was fine. I mean, he, you know, difficult two putt. But he was able to make it.
But is that a choke, or is that just, you know, you're playing Augusta and, you know, you're in the Masters? Is that really a choke, or is it just that at some point the course gets you?
I think it's a little bit of a choke, only because, you know, I was joking with you guys by text that, you know, with the basketball analogy, you didn't have to go for 3. You could go for 2.
Right.
I mean, you know, just put it on the fat of the green and let it roll down and give yourself a shot at a birdie putt. But he went for everything. He went to even up the whole match on that. And I think that was the mistake. I think he made a mental mistake, and he says he hit a perfect shot and he hit it flush, but obviously directionally it wasn't a perfect shot.
Well, how bad was his third shot too?
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah. I mean, it was 2 in a row.
Yeah.
Right. That's what made me think nerves got to him, because it was like,
if he could have got up and down and bogeyed, then, you know, he would still have been within shouting distance. But I mean, you know, it was what, five shots after he got off the green.
You know who I think is a big picture choke is DeChambeau. I mean, you know, 2 years ago and in, you know, in stark contrast to Matsusuma, 2 years ago, he arrogantly brags that he thinks his course plays like a 67 instead of a 72
because of par fives.
And since that time, he's shot a 70, a 74, a 69, a 73, 76, 67, 75, 75, and finished, you know, a plus 5 for this. And in 2020, he was, what, 18 shots behind DJ. I mean, you talk about a choke. He keeps bragging about being a bomber, and he's screwing up the par threes this year. He was plus 8 on par threes this year.
Horrendous putting. But at the same time, I mean, he only hit 55% of the fairways. You're not going to bring Augusta to its knees by hitting 55% of the fairways. I mean, there was one time I saw him on 13. He hit the ball at a place that the announcers go, that's not where normally you hit the ball. And he had 160 in, and he hit a wedge in, and he got an eagle on the final round. If he could have done that on a consistent basis, he would have won going away, but he couldn't keep the ball in the fairway.
But
why not hit a 3-wood off the tee if that's how far you hit the ball and be in play on all these
holes? That's not how he rolls.
And that doesn't explain his horrible play on par threes.
In Masters, one of the names of the game is strokes gained. So even when you're not in the fairway, you've got to be able to scramble. You've got to be able to gain strokes from the rough. I mean, that's what was so
second
impressive.
Cut.
Yeah. Sorry, Augusta. Sorry.
You want to play there. Second cut.
Butler Cabin. I don't think I'm going to get that opportunity. But listen, I want to make sure that folks understand that Hideki, no question about it, he won this tournament. Nobody lost this tournament to Hideki. I mean, he got to a point where he was almost on autopilot. Yes, he had a couple of shaky holes at the end, but he was just so, so solid. And he, you know, what did he get up to at one point? He got it up to minus 13.
13.
On, yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you.
I don't know. I hear your
point. But look, I don't want to take anything away from the guy who won the Masters. That's not my intention here. But so many guys, particularly that this group of people thought would be in contention, just shit the bed in the first 2 days and were out of it. I mean, you could argue a lot of people lost it on Thursday and Friday.
I mean, look at the big names who missed the cut. It's amazing. Yeah. Just amazing. Look,
DJ, defending champion.
Yeah,
but I would argue though that Rose, more than any other golfer, lost the tournament. I mean, he shoots a 65 on Thursday. It's his tournament to lose. I mean, everybody said that. He's up by 4 shots. All he had to do was shoot 4 under in 3 days, and he would have got 11 under. He would have won the tournament.
Isn't that preposterous, though? Isn't that a preposterous statement that where he was at the end of the day Thursday at the Masters, it's his tournament to lose? You can't say that.
Not at all.
Win the Masters on Thursday.
If all Rose had to do was shoot 70 the next 3 days, and he would have won going away.
I would love to know the number of wire to wire winners ever in the Masters.
Spieth, obviously.
Very, very few.
Tiger.
The winds kicked in on Saturday and Sunday, and what you saw Rose do over and over, he could not gauge the wind. He was just launching it over green after green after green. You know, their conditions change. The conditions aren't the same as Thursday.
He put himself in a position with his Thursday round that if he had had decent rounds, the 2 out of the next 3 days, he would have won the tournament. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about going low. He didn't have to go low on any of those 3 days.
Can we talk about the most interesting part of the entire Masters? Without a doubt, the most interesting story of the entire weekend was the arrival of Zalatoris. House, I totally agree with this.
Adam Sandler's caddy.
This was your favorite part.
Happy Gilmore.
You guys want to talk about Lightning McQueen? Ka-chow! Ka-chow!
Owen Wilson.
Listen, it is a very nice story. The guy, all 125 pounds of him, he's got a very nice swing.
Wait, I'm going to interrupt for a second, just for our listeners. Whenever one of us says, look, it was a nice story, that means that previously someone's been sending text messages talking about what a fucking asshole the guy is, how this is ridiculous. And then we come on here and we dial it back about 11 degrees. So that's kind of what's happening.
It's a judicial version of With All Due Respect.
That's right.
I just think that it's a good story. He's a nice player. We were talking about this on the pod a few weeks ago, how desperate the PGA needed like a new face, somebody to grab onto. You could hear that in the broadcast booth. They were pretending like he was a 16-year-old who'd never played golf before. He is 24 years old, not 20, not 21. He's not a Spieth. He's not a Matthew Wolf. He's not one of these guys that just got, you know, onto the tour. He's 24 years old with a really nice swing, and he was overwhelmed by the moment of the back nine. Are we all
came in second?
He came in second.
Whoa. He's solo second place.
Okay, but
he shot a 70, right?
Yes, he shot a 70 on Sunday.
Sole possession of second place. He's overwhelmed by about 1.7 million in winnings, right? Too. On that,
he came in second because Schauffele went in the water on 16. I mean, you know, I think he's a nice player. But this gushing love affair that everyone's having with Will Zalatoris. I'll just say this, cousin Nace, don't bet your future, your next house on Will Zalatoris.
Is he still technically a rookie? He's not even on the tour.
He doesn't have his tour card.
But can we confirm, did somebody call Child Protective Services? Because clearly this kid has been malnourished his entire life growing up. I mean, there really ought to be an investigation into that.
at least now that he has some money in his pocket, maybe he can afford his three meals a day.
I mean, he's a 28 waist size, for God's sake.
Yeah. Looks like milk.
Look,
DeChambeau's bicep is 28 inches.
He and Milk are going to binge and purge together.
Wow.
Let me tell you something. I love this kid. I want to see more of him. Goff is, and I said this morning, sometimes it gets very robotic. It's a very, you know, it's a very relational sport. It's a very individualistic sport, right? So as fans, often we like find ourselves, we like the players we kind of connect with. It's kind of the reason I hate Brooks Koepka, because I don't connect with him at all, with his nice strut and everything he does. But it's like this Zalatoris
means winning.
Yeah,
winning is what he means.
And he went to FSU, but that's another
thing. Yeah, I might say he's a Knoll.
But it's like this Zalatoris kid, he's kind of like, he might be playing in a foursome with you on a Saturday, right? Like he might be your guest at your member guest. And at the end of the member guest, everyone's making fun of him, calling him Owen Wilson and Happy Gilmore's caddy. Like he kind of just, he has a good sense of humor. He's the kind of guy you want to go golf with and have a couple beers. I like him. I hope this isn't a one-time thing. I liked how look, we've seen a lot of guys go into Sunday with that pressure and come out shooting 82, 83.
Right.
I think the 70 was, and I was pretty impressed by that.
That putt on 18 was so clutch. That made Hideki have to think about his tee shots on 17 and 18. I mean, that two shot, that was huge.
Yeah.
And it, nice. Obviously, as Rooster pointed out earlier, I mean, it backed him at $1.27 million for a guy who's not even on the tour.
Nice.
But I think there was somebody on the pod who went out, as he's wont to do, and made a very bold prediction about this guy's future. You care to repeat that?
How are you talking about?
I don't think you're going to see Will Zalatoris win a major. Oh, I just don't. Wow. I just don't. I don't think the guy, first of all, you do need to be over 125 pounds. I do think the more they lengthen these courses to protect them against Bryson, you know, to protect them against Brooks Koepka, the harder it's going to be for now. The Masters, he's a great ball striker. So the Masters played well into his game, but you know, it'll be interesting to see him develop and I will be rooting for him. I don't think he's got the kind of play that's going to be winning Masters.
If the wind blows at Kiowa, are we a little worried he might get blown off the tee box?
Exactly.
Yeah. You have to wear ankle weights.
Look, so let's close up here on the Masters. Overall, and we haven't talked about Tiger not being there. Obviously, none of these big names, maybe Spieth, you can throw him in there, were in contention. You know, how did that affect it? What did y'all think? I mean, was it boring? What was it like without Tiger? Did it make a difference? I mean, where do you guys fall on this?
I didn't think it made a difference. I thought it was good to see Justin Rose back. It was good to see Jordan Spieth back.
Definitely.
And yeah, it was a fun tournament.
It was not a drama filled tournament. It just wasn't. You know, there was a moment there, 15, 16, I guess, where you thought, oh, maybe this is going to tighten up. But by and large, it wasn't that exciting. And I don't think that had anything to do with Tiger being there or not. I mean, there could have been a number of other players who were in contention and putting pressure on, and it could have been exciting. It just wasn't that exciting. I mean, that doesn't take away, again, from Hideki's performance and what he did, but it just wasn't exciting.
I agree. I mean, except for when Tiger runs away with it, there was something about when Tiger ran away with it that it was still really fascinating and fun to watch. But when someone's running away with a tournament generally, whether it's a big name or not as well-known name like Hideki, like, you know, when Rory went crazy at Congressional or even DJ last year,
yeah,
it's just not as fun. It's much more fun, like Pope was saying while we were texting, it's much more fun when there's drama. And the Masters lack the drama this year. So in that respect, it just was a little less exciting.
And look, I was not rooting against Hideki. I hoped he would win. I just wanted to see a little drama. And I think his victory is even more special because he did have to hit the shot. When, you know, they said, when do you think in your mind, you know, that you had won the green jacket? He said, when I hit that drive on 18, because, you know, he easily could have hit the ball into the woods and got trapped and potentially had to make a big putt just to go to a playoff. I mean, there was drama. It wasn't the likely drama, you know, that you see almost every year at the Masters. I would give it, if I rank the tournament, I'm going to give it a 7.
Yeah. You almost don't even feel that he only won by one stroke. Feels like more than that.
Well, right. Tiger won by one stroke because he had two strokes to play with on the 18 tee box, and he was able to cozy up a two putt, which is exactly what Hideki did. Thank you.
I do agree with Rooster that it's good to, in particular, it's good to see Spieth back. It's two consecutive weeks. I do think Spieth is back. I think he'll be back and play for majors, and you will see Schauffele win a major. The guy is just there, major after major after major. He will win a major.
Yep.
And let's hope that this is a start of a several consecutive Brooks Koepka missing the cut.
And with any luck, will Zalatoris win the very next major played? Because that would be very special for the SMQBs if that could happen.
And Patrick Reed and DeChambeau continuing to choke, that would be fun too.
Yes.
All right.
Well, what do we got next, Nace?
House. Your Phillies. They stole one last night, huh?
It was a really entertaining game. The Braves are a good team. You know, they won last year, the division, and they'll be back again this year. So the Phillies had a weekend contest against the Braves. They lost the first two in a highly entertaining game last night. It goes to the top of the ninth. The game is 6-6. And Alec Bohm, the Phillies third baseman, makes it to third base with one out. And Didi Gregorius hits a pop fly to shallow left field. And amazingly, the Phillies third base coach decided to send Bohm. And Marcell Ozuna was the left fielder who normally does not have a great arm. It was pretty much a bang-bang play at the plate, and the umpire immediately called Bohm safe. I kind of thought, just in live action, that he was safe. Of course, the Braves went straight to replay, and in a replay that must have taken at least 5 minutes. And if you were watching it on ESPN, and if you didn't watch it live and you watch it the next day, you will not see an angle that convinces you that Bohm was safe. You won't even see an angle that persuades you that Bohm was safe. And in fact, if you just go on to Google and you put in search Alec Bohm safe, you won't find a still image. You will not find a single frozen still image where Alec Bohm, any part of his foot, is clearly on the plate.
You know why that is?
Because he probably wasn't
on the plate. Because he never touched the plate.
I guess the best argument is not when he slid in initially, but when he finished his slide, he did a little twirl, and it looked like it was possible that his toe might have touched the plate at that point before DiArno applied the tag. But even then, you should have seen some dirt clear from the plate, and you didn't really see it. And again, you can't find a still image of the toe touching the plate. And the officials said of Major League Baseball that they didn't see enough evidence to overturn the call on
what's the standard?
Field.
What's the standard?
That's the standard. The standard has to be that there has to be clear evidence to overrule the call on the field. And so Bohm was marked safe. And
so
of
if
course,
he had been out, then you think it would have been upheld.
It would have been upheld. And, there we go again into all the controversy that by the way, the Braves fans, the Braves players, the players went nuts. The coaches went nuts. The fans threw garbage on the field. I mean, and of course, it's dominating a lot of the
kind of like
headlines.
A Philadelphia football game.
By the way, that might be the most remarkable thing of the whole play was that the Braves fans showed any emotion about what happened on the field.
Right.
You know, I just think this is so silly. Like, oh, and the NL East is such a close division, and if this whole season is decided by one game, this is going to be the game. I have a feeling there are going to be other games the Braves are going to lose in close games that might decide a one game season, but whatever. Video replay has a problem. across every sport. I think a sport that gets kind of close to getting it right sometimes is the NFL, only because there's the coach's challenge and you can decide whether or not you want to challenge a play. But even then, certain plays aren't challengeable. And even then, it's a strategy decision whether or not to call a play. And, you know, let's not forget in the NFL how badly they've messed up video replay. You guys remember in 2019, at the end of the season, the 49ers were playing the Seahawks, and at the end of the game, the Seahawks threw a pass to their tight end, and the guy gets mugged in the end zone, and it's under 2 minutes, and they decide not to review the call, and the Seahawks don't score, and as a result, the 49ers get the number one seed, and the Saints get knocked out of a bye and have to play a wild card. So the Saints go into the wild card and they play the Vikings. And you guys might remember that game in the playoffs goes to overtime, 20-20, and the Vikings go all the way down the field. And again, there's a clear offensive pass interference where Kyle Rudolph gets separation from the Saints defender. Rudolph scores the touchdown. And because it's a touchdown in overtime, the Saints never get the ball back and the game ends. And it was clear offensive pass interference, and yet they didn't change the call. And one of my questions is about video replay is, if the evidence is there, what's the point of having video? This is what all the Braves players were saying last night and the coaches. What is the point of having video replay if you're never going to change the calls? If the standard is such that it needs conclusive evidence or whatever, I just think that video replay should, number one, only be used by coaches. And if there's evidence that shows that the play was wrong, you call it wrong. Otherwise, leave the human element in the game. Sometimes refs get it right. Sometimes refs get it wrong. Do you guys think video replay should be in these games?
So as a matter of course, I hate hearing about people complaining about referees and calls costing them games. Because, you know, if you don't like the call at the plate in the top of the ninth, then don't let the game be 6-6 going into the top of the ninth, right? I mean, so that's my starting point, is I hate this. But we put video replay into these games with the goal of getting the calls right. The statement was, well, look, referees, the game's fast, the officials, you know, they make mistakes. Humans make mistakes. We can correct that. But now what we're doing is we're letting humans in a box in New York or in a studio somewhere, they're making mistakes. We haven't eliminated human error from any of this. Or maybe the mistake is the way the rule is put into place, the replay rules are put into place in a boardroom somewhere with a competition committee. We have not eliminated human error from affecting games. All we've done is slowed games down by 5 to 10 minutes while people look at calls. And now we just have a different human to be angry at when they keep a call. It doesn't work. It doesn't fix games. I would just get rid of all of it at this point. Let's just have the referees call the game. And you know what? There are going to be games that are won and lost based on a referee not seeing something. I mean, the most egregious one you can think of, and there was no way to fix it, was the umpire in baseball, Jeffries, who got the perfect game wrong for the Detroit
pitcher,
that kid who was like a rookie or whatever, and he had a perfect game going, and the guy blew the call at first base by about 2 steps, and he couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, I mean, that's about the most egregious one around, but still, let's just move on with this. It doesn't work. It hasn't fixed the games to where we don't have any mistakes in games anymore. So let's just not even deal with it. That would be my take.
It seems to me that Major League Baseball's goal, overriding goal, isn't to make sure that it works. They're confused. They have the technology to get it right, but they have this overriding philosophy of, we don't ever want to question our human beings' judgment calls, our umpires' judgment calls. Well, everything is a judgment call. If the technology can get you the right answer and you're going to use it, then get it right.
Exactly.
But stop mixing and matching what you're doing out there. You know, there are a lot of calls that we'll get to this later with a Conforto issue. But there are a lot of things that are not, they're reviewing the play, but they're parts of the play that are not reviewable. So they know what the right answer is, and they can't get it right because they put themselves in a box with the stupid rules they've imposed because they're so biased against second guessing their umpires.
Pope, you know a little something about a video replay in a playoff game. One Dez Bryant versus the Green Bay Packers.
It was a catch. It was a,
and that's what they called it.
And he made
field,
a football
right?
move. And he made a football move. They called it a catch on the field and they overturned it. Said he didn't make a football move before he fumbled.
And ever since that day, nobody has any idea what a catch is in the NFL now. I mean, your guess is as good as mine.
The human observation on the field was the guy made a catch. Move on. Keep the play going. Right. And
the one they took away from Megatron, I think, was even worse. I can't remember the circumstances, but it was such a clear touchdown. They took it away from him, and it almost sucked the life out of him after that. He just had no joy left and retired soon after.
I mean, should you add video replay in for the playoffs because the games mean more? Should you add video replay? I mean, I kind of agree what Rooster says. Like, if you have the technology and you have evidence of it, don't be afraid of overruling your umps and protecting your humans. Get the play right. Use the technology for what it is.
Use it quickly. Use it quickly and get it right, like the SEC does in football now. In basketball. Remember I think it was the LSU. I can't remember. End of the year, LSU in basketball. The SEC has its own crew. They're not sending these things to New York to be reviewed. They're doing it pretty much on the spot, and they're making quick judgment calls. By the time the refs get to the sidelines, they've got the call, and they just come back and announce it, and the game moves on. I mean, there's a way to do this right. I think they should get it right.
I've seen it very effective in stealing plays, like when the guy going down to second and that quick slide, quick tag out. And then, you know, inevitably they review it and you get a really solid look and he either beats the tag or not. But I mean, there's been many a time, at least in games I've seen personally, where the umpires have absolutely been overruled. So I think it can be effective. It's just a question of, you know,
the irony is it was such a dumpster fire in the NFL that from 92 to 98, you know, they took it away. They started the NFL with it in 86. It went for 6 years and then it was a dumpster fire of a situation. And then they claim that the technology got better to bring it back in 99. And it's been like a real headache ever since. You know, the last pre-COVID season in 2019, there were 13 coach initiated challenges on pass interference and none were overturned, which means that the refs, presumably on the field, the humans are pretty much getting it right. The worst of all of them, though, the worst, because it's in every sport, but the worst of all of them is if you watch Premier League soccer and you know, all of us watch Premier League soccer, they have this, you know, video assisted referee VAR. And they use it on everything, on fouls, on offsides, on everything. You know, leave it to handballs, leave it to penalties inside the box, but it slows the game down. Yesterday, there was a crucial call that changed a play in the game. Video is not helping sports. It's slowing it down. It's taking away the human element. Now, I say that until one of my teams gets screwed, but.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Until it benefits you.
And Tottenham and Man UK, I mean, I have no idea why VAR even got involved in that. That was just a play through. Son from Tottenham got hit in the face, but I mean, it wasn't violent. It wasn't intentional. And they, you know, they called off a goal. Obviously Man U came back and won, but the VAR and the EPL has been the bane of many people who are watching that, especially over in England. I mean, they're up in arms about it because they think it's changing the face of football over there. And there's a big movement to get rid of it because, you know, they say they don't even recognize the old observers. So they don't even recognize the game anymore because of VAR. I mean, you've got in action in the penalty box, you got a kick and a guy does this and it hits his shoulder as he's trying to get out of the way. And they call that a handball, give him a PK and the game is over in stoppage time. I mean, they've got to do something about that. But, you know, I did a little bit of research for this segment. What percentages do you guys think of the overturn, unless you already know, for Major League Baseball? How many calls do you think are overturned?
God, you know what? Before we answer that, I just thank you, Pope, for having a stat. I knew it was going to come eventually.
I love it.
I was waiting for it. It only took 45 minutes, but it's here. Let's go for it.
It's my favorite part of the pod.
I'll bet you it's 18%.
12%.
No, 42%.
Are overturned?
Are overturned, yeah.
That's about what I'm saying. I think it's more. I think.
How about NFL?
20%.
Oh, in the NFL, I'll bet you it's like 60%. Because of the challenges by the coach.
Rooster?
50.
41%.
Huh.
And NBA, the other sport that I've found.
Oh, the NBA, 65. But the NBA changes a call and then they change it to something else. They don't just overturn. I mean, they're like, the NBA is a mess. I mean, well, they're just a mess.
It's 19%. It's a lot.
Wow.
You know, coaches' challenges on NBA is real tough. It costs you a timeout. So,
yeah,
be careful.
Well, let's look. This is, I mean, if the referees want to screw up games, you know, that's fine. Let the refs screw it up. Let's not let the leagues and these stupid rules and all this replay slow the games down. Just make it so unbearable to watch and screw it up. You know, I personally, I'd much rather watch a guy who's doing a little cheating behind the scenes and trying to get something around the referees like Trevor Bauer, right? Can we talk about Trevor Bauer? I mean,
oh man,
there's so much crap going on in these games besides, you know, just calling balls and strikes and referees or umpires and whatever. Let's talk about the Trevor Bauer story.
I'll be interested to see where Mr. Purist comes down on this one, but I call this segment, your favorite pitcher has been cheating his ass off for a long time and Major League Baseball didn't care until Trevor Bauer opened his big fat mouth.
Yeah.
You know, Trevor Bauer wrote in one of his many tweets about 2 years ago that he's been trying to chase down the spin rate because he's identified it as such a massive advantage. He says, vertical movement is way more important than velocity. And if he can get the right spin rate, he's going to be awesome. And he said he's been trying since 2012, he couldn't find anything that worked really well except using foreign substances. And he turned around and said, and guess what the Astros are doing 2 seasons ago? That's exactly what they're doing. They're cheating Major League Baseball. And Major League Baseball said, go away. It's a commonly known secret. Shut up, Trevor Bauer. We don't want to hear it. So Bauer's like, okay, fuck you. And he starts doing it last year. His spin rate goes up something like 500 RPMs in one season, and he wins the Cy Young. So now Major League Baseball is like, okay, well, you know what? We just so happen to have this new technology called StatCast, where we've got all these fancy cameras everywhere, and we can actually measure spin rates. And wow, yours really did go up. So they confiscated a bunch of his baseballs, and this guy who was trying to change the system, I think, is going to wind up getting suspended for calling attention to it in the first place. And he is a jerk. Don't get me wrong. I know, Milk, you hate him. I mean, he came out recently and called Ken Rosenthal a gossip blogger, as if the guy isn't a serious journalist. You know, he's a jerk. But I kind of feel like he put himself out there and said to Major League Baseball, I'm doing this. I'm telling you I'm doing this, and I dare you to do something about it.
So should we talk about his record-setting contract now or after we get to the end of the segment about when he started cheating and when he signed that contract?
Appropriate. Yeah, point. But I mean, I think he tweaked his nose at Major League Baseball, and they finally had no choice but to look into this.
Didn't you have a theory that he might have done that on purpose to even bring more attention to it by getting suspended?
I do. I think that he dared them to challenge him. He didn't hide it. He told them he was doing it. He put it in writing.
you know, and
they lay the hammer down on him. Lay the hammer, go get. I'd eight men out him, get him out of baseball entirely. I can't have this guy.
But before the stat cast came in, how many pitchers do you, what percentage of pitchers do you think were doing this?
I would say there are hundreds of pitchers who are doing this right now. And one of them got his baseballs confiscated.
Well, he's an idiot. He brought it. He asked this to happen.
But so, they can. So like House was saying, StatCast has been able to measure the spin rate. And so spin rates and strikeouts have gone up every year in like the past 5 years. Why is that?
So it should surprise no one that the Astros were the organization that really sort of figured out the spin rate thing in the first place, right? I mean, I've read stories about pitchers, you know, who went there after, you know, being in the majors and had these devices, these StatCast devices around and learned about spin rate and how to utilize spin rate and how to increase spin rate too and what a difference it can make. So, you know, the fact that this all started with the Astros should shock exactly nobody. But, you know, putting something on the baseball to make it move funny, I mean, this goes back, talk about eight men out. I mean, it goes back before the 1918 Black Sox scandal, right? I mean, it goes way back. It's, you know, it's kind of funny because this is just what baseball cannot get out of their own way, Major League Baseball. I mean, the whistle gets blown on this thing a couple of years ago and they don't do anything. And it's the same thing. Everybody knew the Astros were banging trash cans and cheating before the story broke. Everyone in the majors knew what was going on. And Major League Baseball does not want to deal with this stuff until they absolutely have to. And so now you have Bauer who he may have brought it on himself and maybe intentionally, but this is just such a clumsy situation for baseball. And now what are they going to do? Because we know that there's probably a really high percentage of pitchers who are doing this every night when they take them out.
And they've gone way beyond, you know, a little pine tar on the back of the hat. They're using these custom blended stuff and, you know, expensive blends that are hard to detect. And pretty soon, you know, it's going to be standard fare. I mean, and it is, I mean, they're doctoring the baseball. The game is named for the ball. Yeah. Shouldn't there be some integrity in the damn ball?
Well, listen, I mean, like Bison was saying, this has been going on forever. I remember, I guess it's within the last 6 or 7 months, one of the Yankee greats that passed away, it was Whitey Ford. And so much of the stories that were written about Whitey Ford were about how he was famous for doing that little something to the baseball, you know, that affected it. This has been going on forever. How much does this bother you, Bison? You're the professional baseball player here. How much does it bother you that people doctor or mess with the baseball from the pitching mound?
So here's where it becomes offensive. Like Rooster was just saying, we've gone to these exotic substances now that like guys are like plotting out what can I put on the ball and how can I not get caught? I mean, it's just like, look, people have been stealing signs in baseball since the start of the game. But when the Astros put a camera out in center field and start watching and relaying the pitch to the batters, you know, now it's a conspiracy. Like, right. It's just more offensive at that point. And that's where it becomes offensive. Now, this isn't a guy who's putting a little Ben Gay on his shoulder and scratching and going to the glove. I mean, these guys are like sitting down and plotting it out.
Right.
It's almost like the steroid thing, you know, where people were trying to figure out what substance can I put in my body that won't be caught on a test. I mean, that's where we're going now. It's too much gamesmanship at this point. It's not just about getting an edge. It's flat out cheating. It's just cheating when you're going to that sort of trouble and it's part of your pregame ritual or even your off-season conditioning program is to come up with the best substance to alter the flight of the ball. That's cheating.
Even Gaylord Perry would be ashamed by these pitchers.
I don't think so.
The positive in all this is there's going to be so many more hanging breaking balls now that are going to be launched out of the ballpark now that these guys can't use this stuff.
Well, that's what we need, more home runs. That's exactly what the game needs.
I want more
home runs. It does, for some excitement.
Especially off Trevor Bauer. Hey, anybody?
It'll also mean more bean balls because they can't control the ball as well.
Yeah. Anybody who pitches in spring training with their eyes closed, I wish nothing but ill will on them. You're going to pitch with your eyes closed? No. Get them out of the game.
So, interesting story, because, you know, one thing I'm not sure about, I'm not sure that Bauer is the only guy who's had his balls grabbed by Major League Baseball, which there's just too many options here. But try and keep it family friendly a little bit.
Just this round, just this one reach around, it was only him.
Episode 13, balls episode. Yeah.
How do we not hear from the purist on this? Come on, House, what do you got?
I don't know what it is about this whole thing with just these little tweaks inside the glove that's something endearing about pitchers getting away with. There's just something like, you know, when they take the brim of the cap and they put their little sweat on their two fingers, there's something endearing about the pitcher getting away with just that little bit.
But that's not what they're doing. These guys have Kim Jong-un just, you know, declaring, like, developing, you know, weapons of mass destruction that they can put on the ball and no one can find.
And sometimes it's the catcher now doing it, not the pitcher.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's going to be the next thing is when the pitcher says, right, I didn't do it. The catcher did it. Who did this? The catcher must have done this.
Must have been the home plate umpire.
Nace, you nailed it. Because if you don't do something, these guys will take it to the extreme. They will have a scientist in a basement creating some substance that's better than the other substance. You got to stop it or they will just go all in.
Yeah, where's that Balco guy now? What's he doing? He's working with pitchers probably.
Right.
Someone's calling him up. Hey, man, can you create some gunk for me?
He's got a company called Stick'em.
Yeah.
It's the beauty of baseball because the equipment includes a glove and a bat and a ball and a helmet and a cap and all these different things that players can do something with. There's always going to be an effort to see what you can do to work around the game to improve yourself. You know, it's a game filled with stats and the smallest margin of error. There's something about it that's kind of endearing. I don't care for Trevor Bauer, but I hope that they don't shut these pitchers down because the last thing I wanted to see is a bunch of 14, 12 games in the American League where they have no pitchers hitting and that crap.
Yeah. I'm with you. Well, you know, speaking of Trevor Bauer, this seems like an appropriate place to come up with our punchable face of the week, right?
It's this week's punchable face.
I'm going to start out punchable face by reading a rule to you, Major League Baseball rule 5.05B2. A batter can proceed to first base if he is, quote, touched by a pitch ball, which he is not attempting to hit unless, A, the ball is in the strike zone when it touches the batter, or B, the batter makes no attempt to avoid being touched by the ball. So if it's a strike, it doesn't matter if he's trying to avoid being hit. If it's a strike, it's a strike, and he cannot take first base. That's what the rule says. So 4 days ago, the Marlins and the Mets are playing. It's the bottom of the ninth, and tie score, and the Marlins relief pitcher is just struggling mightily, a guy named Anthony Bass. Bases are loaded. He's got Michael Conforto in a 1-2 count. He throws him a perfect curveball right over the heart of the plate for strike three. The umpire, Ron Culpa, is about to call strike three, you're out. And just as he starts to call it, Conforto leans in with his heavy armor on his elbow and the pitch nicks his arm. So Culpa sends him to first base for a walk-off hit by pitch, which just complete bullshit. It violates the rule. And you know what? I'm with you, Chris. I'm not terribly upset about players pushing the limit. So I'm not saying that it's Conforto who gets the punchable face. people make mistakes. And even Ron Culpa came out after the game and said, I made a big mistake. I should have called him out. So now they're calling him Mea Culpa.
Mea Culpa.
My punchable face is Major League Baseball because, you know, Donnie Baseball, the manager of the Marlins, immediately protests. So they go to the replay and they look at the replay. And all they're allowed to look at was, did the ball make contact with Conforto? Because they deem the question of whether it was a strike or whether Conforto, if it wasn't a strike, tried to avoid being hit. They deem that as a judgment call that Culpa had to make. That's not reviewable. The problem is the review made it absolutely clear, A, it was a strike, and Conforto leaned into it intentionally trying to be hit. He made no effort to avoid it. If you got the technology, like I said before, use it and get it right. He was out and he should have been called out, and they just ignored the technology. They ignored the clear visual evidence, and the Marlins got robbed of a game, basically. So I give punchable face to Major League Baseball for being such pussies that they're so afraid to, you know, they're just so afraid to offend their umpires because they have a judgment call they're supposed to make. Fuck you, Major League Baseball. Get it right. Boom. Wow. And by the way,
I have to do some editing there.
Oh, by the way, the NCAA got this right a few years ago. And it was involving Conforto again. Conforto was a hell of a hitter for Oregon State. And in 132 at-bats, he got hit by 38 pitches his last year in college. Huh. And the NCAA said, well, that's enough of that. So now in the NCAA, the judgment call the ump gets to make is, if he thinks that the player tried to get hit, he can call it a strike. Instead of taking first base, it's a strike on the batter. Get it right.
You know, I agree with you. I think I agree with you on every point, but I want to add one. There's a simple way to stop guys from like this leaning in, and that is to outlaw some of this Kevlar body armor,
right,
that
right.
they're wearing. I mean, we have guys in our military who are jealous of the armor that Major League Baseball players so wear up true. At the plate. I mean, you take that armor off of his front arm there, and some pitcher, you know, puts a 96 mile an hour four seamer into his shoulder or his ribs, and he's not going to hang over the plate like that. Now, you don't want to do it with the bases loaded in the bottom of the last inning, but you get the point. I mean, these guys, they're up there armored. I mean, this was Barry Bonds. I mean, Bonds did this.
Yep.
I mean, good Lord, what did he have on? And he stood over the plate, and you know, the pitcher was already at a disadvantage. That guy cheated in every way possible, now that you think about it. But take the armor out of the game and punish these guys. They want to get hit by a pitch, I'll hit you with a pitch.
Who's gonna stick their elbow into a 90 mile plus exactly. per hour fastball ever? Unless it's just covered in Kevlar.
I mean, you know, he practices that. How do I get my armor just to the point where it nicks the ball coming over the strike zone and, you know, I can get a base when I need a base? Well,
right.
You need one base and you win the game. Perfect that, opportunity.
And I don't fault him for doing this. I mean, he's trying to win the game for his team. But I will tell you that Ron Darling and Hawk Harrelson in the Mets booth hated it. They hated it. They were disgusted that the Mets won that game that way.
Yeah, as they should.
Well, it's because they're purists.
They're purists like Kraus.
First, let me, from this purist point of view, let me just first say the Federal Communications Commission, please don't punch us in the face, but Mike Fallon's on vacation and he's had a drink or two. But second of all, I agree with everything that you said, except for I do believe that the punch should go to Conforto's face. I mean, you can't just finish a whole discussion about trying to stop these guys from cheating. What Conforto was trying to do was cheat. He was trying to cheat his way to victory in that game. Yes, Major League Baseball compounded the problem, but Conforto leaned in like Pope said. He practiced it with this Kevlar on, and he took one on the arm for a win. He deserves the first punch in the face, and then you come in with the uppercut to Major League Baseball.
Look, he violated the two rules that Rooster laid out in the very beginning. That's, in essence, cheating.
But let me push back on that, because I'm pretty damn sure that there's a rule in baseball against putting a foreign substance on the ball. And none of you had any problem with that until it got to be a little too sophisticated. I mean,
that's my thing with Kevlar. Listen, I don't like the idea of leaning into a pitch like that. But if you're standing up there, bases are loaded, and it's the bottom of the inning, you need to push one in, and a pitcher lets one get away, I don't think you have to drop to the dirt that quickly, right? I mean, if you don't mind taking it in the back or something, you do that. But leaning over the plate, again, with the body armor on, I mean, that's
into the strike zone.
Bush League, into like, the strike
into
zone.
Into the heart of the strike zone.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
But that was just a bad call.
Yeah, what is the ump's responsibility?
That was strike three, regardless of whether it hit him. It was strike three.
The catcher even caught it. That's how little contact there was. Yeah, I mean, it was straight, you know, the catcher caught the pitch.
Well, I'll admit that when I first started thinking about this story, I wanted to give Conforto the punch too. And then I thought about how excited I was when Jim Larritz got hit by a pitch in the World Series for the Yankees in the 90s. And I thought, wow, what a hero. What a great job.
Pete Rose did it too. Pete Rose put his thigh right into a ball.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, between the Phillies Braves game last night, Trevor Bauer in the 2021 spitball version, and Conforto in the hit by pitch, I'm pretty sure Major League Baseball just got their ass kicked up and down this podcast today.
So. Not a good look for Major League Baseball this week.
Yeah.
I just like to say I'm against all of these things that we talked about, unless it benefits my team. Then I'm totally cool.
Yeah, well, you're a small market. You guys got to do what you got to do.
We need any help we can get. So.
That's right. So, all right, guys. Anything else?
Nothing? Big shout out to Hope Troutwine, North Texas Mean Green softball pitcher, who just threw a perfect game yesterday with 21 strikeouts. You know how unbelievable that is? Every single out in the game was recorded by her strikeout. That's a Division I team, too. That's pretty cool.
That's nuts.
That is my favorite softball team.
Oh, there it is. He's connected to it.
Oh, my God. Here we go.
Oh, that is the perfect ending. That is the perfect ending.
On that note,
fellas, everybody have a good week.
See you next week.
See ya. Step friends.